I was watching an old Walter Matthau picture with Ned Beatty and several other principal actors and actresses. It's a hilarious comedy, kind of farcical. Anyway, they make a point of having a dispute that they love to depict in Hollywood movies, the dispute between the jurisdiction of the Federal Bureau of Investigation versus the jurisdiction of the Central Intelligence Agency. And they like to point out that Federal Bureau of the FBI, the jurisdiction of the FBI is within the United States, while the jurisdiction of the CIA is without or outside of the United States. Well, I'm a little confused about the reality of the situation due to certain pertinent facts, and I'll start with the pertinent facts. First of all, nobody really knows what the true, well, I shouldn't say nobody, but most people don't know what the true jurisdiction of the United States is in the first place. Needless to say, the grassy knoll, because of this error, on our part, the commonsensical error of most people, the grassy knoll in Texas, wherein many people believe shots were fired that were the ones who killed JFK, not the ones from the book depository that they found Oswald in. In fact, many people don't even think Oswald ever fired a single shot. So the grassy knoll is actually outside the United States. Now here's the background check for that. Back in the days immediately prior to the War of 1812, in which the British stormed the East Coast and burned the Capitol with all of its records. Oh, actually, I have to go back a little before that. George Washington was not the first president of the United States. He was the first president of the Second Continental Congress, or the Second Constitution of the United States. And in that Second Continental Congress, no one showed up from the first except George Washington. They all alienated themselves because it was against the original principles. One major difference between the first Constitution and the second was the fact that the nation's capital was moved from Philadelphia, where it had been just under one decade, and moved to Washington, D.C. The second major difference that, you know, I think is major is that the jurisdiction for minting and printing money was transferred from the states in the first Continental Congress, the first Constitution, and instead vested solely in the United States Treasury, the nation's treasury. And this made it possible for Washington to impose horrible tariffs on the South, which eventually was a major factor in getting them to want to secede from the Union. The New England states had been considering it decades beforehand, but they never had the motivation or the gall because they really didn't have to. They didn't like being associated with the rest of the country because they were the most productive area of the country, and they didn't want the rest of the country to drag them down by attaching themselves to it. But they really didn't have any beef. That, you know, that's not really a beef. That's just an aggravation. The South had a beef because the South was being attacked by the new country's constitutional administration, and partly due to the fact that the South was not allowed to print its own currency anymore because the Second Continental Congress created that change in our nation's second constitution. Now, the reason why George Washington was called into this was because they offered him, oh, we'll give you the first presidency if you sit as a stooge and don't say a word, don't open your mouth. You know, they didn't want him to object to some of the major changes they were making, and additions and changes and corrections or deletions to the First Continental Congress's first constitution. So they just wanted him to sit there and give his presence, you know, by his association to basically authorize the second constitution, because no one from the first was there. No one from the first approved of what the people instituting the Second Continental Congress were doing. They were doing drastic changes that were very unholy, as the first people who signed the Declaration of Independence would have agreed that it was an atrocity what was happening in the Second Continental Congress. And so all those original signers of the Declaration of Independence were there at the First Continental Congress when the first Constitution was drawn up and our nation's capital was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And every state had the right to mint and coin its own currency and back it up, as the case may be, whatever. So what happened, so this made it easier for Britain to attack our nation's capital when they found something they disagreed with that was taking place in our nation's capital, in our nation's Congress in Washington, D.C. And this made it possible for them to destroy the records of an amendment that was ratified, fully ratified by all the necessary number of states, but we have no record of it. And then the Civil War happened several decades later after 1812 because many of the states were printing this ratified amendment to the Constitution as valid and operational, but it was not being recognized by the our nation's Attorney General because, oh, I don't see any record of it having been ratified, so I guess it never was ratified by the necessary minimum number of states. Well, you know, kind of bogus, because that was the whole point of why Britain invaded us. And we did not win that war. Just because they retreated doesn't mean they lost. They won. They had done their job and left. They didn't need to take over the country. They were doing it already remotely. And we went and made an amendment that would stand in their way and prevent them from having people represent them in public offices of various types. It would have prevented them from having public office because the Constitution twice made it clear that, now this is the second Constitution, made it quite clear that it was naughty for foreign governments to hire people to take their position in public office and for them to take any kind of compensation in exchange for their services to the foreign power. It was considered naughty, but there was no punishment if you were found guilty. And so this amendment was to change all that, and it was ratified just before the War of 1812, which is why they came to destroy the record, and they did, and they left. Now, we still had the record in the state constitutions, such as I believe it was Virginia or West Virginia, the one that supposedly never ratified. They did, because it was right there in their constitution as evidence that they had. So that was the one record we need to validate the state that supposedly never ratified, and if they had, it would have been valid as constitutional law. They did indeed, because the evidence is there clearly that they did, because it was in their state records of their state constitution that they published. Their state version of our nation's constitution that they published. Every state published, you know, their edition of our nation's constitution. And I think it was either Virginia or West Virginia printed the fact that they had, because it was there in their edition, the amendment that supposedly was never ratified by them actually was. Now, what happened after the Civil War and the period of the Reconstruction period immediately after the Civil War was the incorporation of, when the nine congressmen from the South walked out of Congress in March of 1861, we no longer had a quorum to do business in Congress assembled. But we did have a quorum to decide whether or not to do business in the future, and Congress decided never again in perpetuity. And they went home, and they figured that we'd have a third Continental Congress draw up a third constitution and have the remaining northern states and whatever western states wanted to join ratify or, you know, sign on to that third constitution, and we'd have a third administration. We'd have a subsequent presidential administration to replace Lincoln. Unfortunately, that's not the way things happened. Lincoln decided that he was going to play military dictator, and he went with his army to all the homes of the congressmen and senators, and at the barrel of a gun forced them to go back to Washington to pick up where they left off and do business as usual, even though they had no right to do so. And so this constitutes a military dictatorship, essentially. You can't describe it any other way. He also instigated the Civil War in such a way that it would not be obvious. There, instead, it would be obvious that the South fired the first shot, but he goaded them to fire the first shot in a very fraudulent way by sending equipment and supplies, food and water, not ammunition and not infantry, down to Fort Sumter in an ironclad. Now, you never do that. You send food and water in a clipper ship, or you send ammunition and guns and cannons and cannonballs and whatnot, you know, fighting machines and infantry in an ironclad. And when the South saw the ironclad approaching the port to dock and unload whatever it had inside, they assumed it was articles and personnel of war, instead of what it actually was food and water. So they fired the first shot because they had to make sure that the ironclad did not unload its cargo and disallow it from tying up at port. So this way, Lincoln could claim, oh, I'm repressing the rebellion. And he thought he was going to go very quickly and be done with, and instead it got out of hand. And this is where the whole military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower had to face firsthand as president, that he didn't realize when the fullest scope, I guess, while he was general over there in Europe, to what degree corporations have infiltrated military and vice versa. And it was all due to the fact that the military got into manufacturing. You know, all of our firms, you know, the women went in, the one time they had a chance to go to work, they went in to the various manufacturing plants to build artillery and ammo and whatnot. And that's when the commercialization of the military really got into full force and full existence, and it's been a military-industrial complex ever since. But the incorporation of the United States of America as a corporation, as a business, occurred during the Reconstruction periods immediately following the Civil War. And if you go and look in the federal codes and of regulations, you will find, if you look up the definition of the United States of America, you will find that among the many various definitions, there are more than one. One of them actually says that the United States of America means a federal corporation. And this is no different than the West Indies Company that was formed in Europe to claim territorial rights and jurisdiction to the New World in order to take home all of the goods and products manufactured here, such as tobacco and whatnot, and never pay a penny to the Indians, you know, because they didn't have ownership ideas anyway. let's see. And this, you know, just like the East Indies Company corporation did the same thing to India, and I guess China as well, and Mongolia, but mostly India, I guess. Any case, so now we have a corporation running the country, and the corporation, see, what they did was they went into the minutes, and they discovered, gee, we've been sitting in Congress and Senate all this time when we should not have been doing so, because we had no legitimate government. Yet we've been doing it, and gee, should we admit it to the public? And they decided not to. So they figured out, if we incorporate Washington, D.C. as a jurisdiction of a corporate entity, and include with that all of the federal territories, such as Army bases, Air Force bases, and whatnot, and territories that never became a state, such as the Philippines, I guess, or Hawaii at the time, yeah, whatever, Alaska. So that's the United States of America, and anything outside of that is foreign to the United States. So this is why the CIA took charge of the assassination of JFK and never break their charter, because they were outside of the United States. They had to be done on in Texas soil or anywhere else outside of the District of Columbia in order to not violate their charter, because that was the extent of, or is the extent of, Washington, D.C., for the most part, other than federal territories and whatnot. Now, the FBI, this is where I get fuzzy. I don't understand how the FBI can get away with assuming that its jurisdiction is within the scope of the 50 states outside of the District of Columbia, because that would supposedly violate its charter. But see, I don't know what its charter is. I just assumed it was within the United States, but I could be very wrong. It could be anywhere on this planet. It may be only the CIA that is restricted to not enter into Washington, D.C., which doesn't amount to a whole lot. But because it, what it means is the jurisdiction, or the enforcement, I should say, within the domain of the United States of America is aptly served by its United States military and Air Force and Marines, you know, Navy, because they are, it's their job to protect the United States against all dangers, foreign and domestic. Anything else, such as police or sheriff, is extra or maybe not even allowed to be in there. I don't know how that works. I think there is a police force in Washington, D.C., but I don't really know if they actually are, you know, legitimately could be. You know, actually, police are hired by cities, is what it amounts to, and sheriffs are hired by the counties, so they may not have a sheriff. I'd venture a guess that they have a police force, but so what? It's hired by the city of Washington, while they may not have a sheriff, because that would be county. So there may be no county in the District of Columbia, unless the District of Columbia is considered its own county. But if that was the case, or is the case, then that means it comes under the jurisdiction of the United States and not under any state, but under the United States of America directly, which makes it a federal county, which is a little bizarre, but that's what it amounts to. So this is what I got out of watching Hopscotch with Walter Matthau, because I realized that the CIA, when they were on the grassy knoll in Dallas, was it Dallas? Dallas, Texas, when they shot Kennedy, they were not breaking their charter at all. They were within their right to manipulate foreign affairs that were foreign to the United States, because it was. Even though it was our nation's president, right? But it was, he was on foreign soil, so they had, whatever, you know, carte blanche. See, was that the point of this recording? Was there something else I wanted to cover? No, I think that was it. So there's a lot of little itty-bitty things here that most people don't know about. You know, that we don't have a legitimate government, that Lincoln had no legitimate presidency after March of 1861. The Civil War was waged as by a tyrant, by a military tyrant. You know, we can say whatever we want to, that Lincoln was a great man, but he was doing an unconstitutional act. So we could say, well, you know, he was making the best of a rotten situation, maybe. He made some assumptions that proved to be incorrect, you know, that the war would be over quickly. And the consequences of that, as I said before, is that we've got a huge military-industrial complex. Now, the reason why we know this, it's not just Eisenhower's warning in his farewell address, and I'll finish, I think, with this. There was a free energy device being developed in Canada, of all places. What does that have to do with us? Absolutely nothing. And yet, Exxon Oil pressured President Eisenhower, while he was still president, to impose himself upon the prime minister or premier, whatever it's called, the leader of Canada at the time, who was a bit of a pushover, you know, it was very easy to push around, a bit of a wimp, to pressure him into shutting down this legitimate company that had already commercially completed projects for military purposes, and now was working on a free energy device that would radically alter how energy gets delivered to the consumer, because it put out somewhere between 5 to 15 times more energy than was put into it, plus it gave you free refrigeration in addition to the electrical output. And it took millions of dollars and less than a decade of research and development, but finally they had it on the verge of commercialization, and it was shut down. And this was a month before Eisenhower left office and JFK took over, and, you know, a month before JFK was going to go, it was a month before JFK went to Canada, was going to go to Canada to meet with these people in his support of their efforts to learn more firsthand. That's usually the way it is with free energy devices. They get killed pretty effectively. Either they're swept aside, or we're all brainwashed to think it's not possible, so we don't support it. In any case, you know, these people up in Canada, they were spending millions of dollars of venture, you know, capital. And they had all the best engineers, you know, and they had already had a track record as it is. So, you know, working for the benefit of military. So it's not like they were a flash in the pan. They had credibility before they even began research on this project. And, you know, they further just added to their credibility, and that's what made it so dangerous to the vested oil interests who want to control everything. Now, they're not in charge. You know, other people are in charge of them. There's a whole, you know, multiple tiers. And ultimately, it's people's ignorance of a better life or a higher consciousness that makes it possible for all these shenanigans to occur in the first place. Because at this point, all we have been able to do in the last century is raise world consciousness so that evil gets their job done more effectively than ever before. But it still is, you know, prideful and controlling and manipulative and privilege-oriented, you know, the haves versus the have-nots. You're up at the top of the pyramid because you deserve it, or you stole it, or whatever, and you've got to claw your way to the top if you want to deserve it, to be there at the top. But that's the only way you get all the goodies. And this is actually the way I was taught in junior high about how communist Russia operates. After the second revolution, not the first. The first was the idealistic one, and would have been fine and dandy had it stayed at that. But somebody felt it was an opportunity waiting to happen to take advantage of the turmoil that happened after the first revolution. So, well, let's have a second and sweep all the idealists aside and get ourselves in. And they were a privilege-oriented communist party that has been there ever since, in which they get all the perks and everybody else has to struggle and strive for limited resources. Well, this is exactly how we operate, except we're too wealthy to notice. We're too well off to notice that we operate basically the same way in that respect. Anywho, so I wanted to talk about this because I felt it was very strange. You know, why would the CIA... Because there is a story afoot that George Bush Sr. was in charge of the operation for those assassins on the grassy knoll, and, you know, all the other distractions and the rerouting of the route that the presidential car took so that it would be in the right place at the right time, very advantageous and all. It was all a CIA operation, and President George Bush Sr. was in charge of it. Whether or not he fired the shot makes no difference at this point, but in any case, so because of that, it kind of gnawed away at me without too much relevance of, you know, why should I care? But there was always that thought. I mean, how would the CIA get away with something that supposedly they're not supposed to do? It's because it's fine and dandy. They can do it. They can get away with it by law. They can get away with it. And that's kind of earth-shaking, because it means our whole country, what we like to think is our country, is literally can be controlled by the CIA. And there has been plenty of instances of inventors who've been swept aside under the rug because there were operatives operating in conjunction with the CIA to make sure that happened. And John Bedini has already made that clear concerning John Shezeka, if I'm saying his name correctly, John Shezeka. who befriended John Bedini and shared with him what his job was, his role, was to seek out and find free energy inventions and devices and make sure they never reach the light of day. And in compensation, he acquired that, and he had more than one warehouse full of all these inventions that were sequestered out of public commerce for good, permanently. And these were the ones within the United States, or I should say within the 50 states. It doesn't include the one from Canada. In any case, well, so I think I've said enough.